because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary.
A rare afternoon podcast recording, Adam. Usually this is this is a morning thing, but not today. Not today.
I used to be in my prime in the afternoon and the evening hours, and mm-hmm. I think it's shifted for me, Robert. I know you're a morning guy.
Well, I'm just like juiced up on caffeine in the morning, and then as the day goes, that tapers away and I get less and less engaging. So, you know, we'll see how this afternoon goes. Could be the case.
In my I didn't really drink coffee till I met Prof. Mm. And I think I'm with you. I think that had a lot to do with it. You got like a 4-hour window, right when you wake up of optimal whatever, and then after that it just really declines throughout the day, doesn't it?
Tapers hard.
The hard taper. Robert, I'm not going to lie to you. I took care of my child by myself for the first time today, and it was a trying experience for about 3.5 hours. So
out of the four. Yeah. Give us the breakdown. What was it like?
Well, she has to start working. So she's back on campus. And, like I said, right before we clicked that button, I can provide the food in the bottle, but it's just not the same comfort for little AJ. So, mm-hmm. We'll just say he was a little irritated with his father, for a bit of time. And he let me know about it. So, you know, that's just part of the deal. And we get to do it all over again tonight for 5 hours.
Night class Monday.
So I got a 5 spot tonight after a rough morning. So, whew, baby.
What are your thoughts on Mondays moving forward the remainder of the year?
I think we should. Yeah. No, that's we're just going to have to see. Someone might have to get hired.
not for your sake, but for AJ's sake.
Yeah, right. Seriously. Not to make it easier on me, just so nothing bad happens to Mr. AJ. Yeah. I'll find my routine, but that routine has not been found yet, unfortunately.
Hey, this is day one of a full semester worth of Mondays. So just buckle up. You'll find your stride, you know.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Robert. A full semester worth of Mondays. That's right. So Robert, I don't think, yeah, we didn't get together last week.
Nope.
But we're certainly not going to recap that APP tournament, but let's talk briefly about it. I know you ended up not able to come to the Tournament of Champions, which was this past weekend in Brigham City, Utah, because of a shoulder injury you suffered at that APP the weekend before. Enlighten us. What's up with all that?
It wasn't anything that really happened in the moment with the shoulder. It's been kind of just a degenerative thing over the past, you know, since starting Pickle, but it only used to bother me on overheads. Whoa, that was weird. Did I stop? I had a call come in and it like erased my screen for a second.
You didn't, you just kind of glitched. You didn't really ever freeze.
Okay. Right on. So I had what I thought was like a rotator cuff issue in college from tennis, and then stopped playing and obviously picked up pickleball like 12, 13 years later. And still felt it like on overheads and pickle, but wasn't really an issue because you don't hit that many of them and it doesn't happen that often. But past few weeks, it's gotten progressively worse to where it was hurting on everything. It was hurting on back, you know, very much a backhand volley, and which is, you know, probably my main shot.
issues
if I get hit a backhand volley. I did some physical therapy this past week, Thursday, Friday, and then went in to see an actual doctor this morning and did x-rays, all that stuff. And it's like a labrum tear, which, you know, doesn't sound great, but it doesn't always like require surgery. It can get better with some rehab and stuff like that. I've never had a cortisone injection, but I got one of those this morning. So I'm hoping it's going to be solid enough to play and not stress about it. But we'll have to be pretty diligent with rehab and stuff. But yeah, I mean, it felt terrible. Had to pull out of TOC. I was going to play with Susanna Barr, who I think she picked up AJ. Is that right, Kohler?
Yeah, I'm looking at the draw right now. I mean, 5 days before, pretty reasonable pickup, I'd say.
Yeah, solid. I don't know why he didn't
You guess.
I mean, he's that guy that goes on standby, and sometimes it just works out. It usually works out for him.
No, I think procrastination pays quite a bit in the partner game. Something happens a month out, or maybe even a month and a half out, something like that, and you don't, instead of going for someone that's maybe a little lesser, you just kind of hold pat and hope it works out. It seems to work out a decent amount of time. I've been in that situation plenty of times.
Well, it didn't work out for Travis Rettmeier, who I was supposed to partner with.
Graham D'Amico. It was actually a pretty fun vibe throughout the tournament because he was, acting like he was a pro and going to the pro tent, making sure he got his credential and stuff like that. And I'm not mistaken, they had a reasonably close first round too.
I think it was a close second game.
A close second game. That's right. Okay, I'm pulling it up now. And if you didn't know, that's just Travis Rettenmeyer's buddy and owner of the Smash and podcast partner. So he is not necessarily in the vicinity of pro level play.
Not glad that it happened, but Travis obviously made the best of it, not being able to get another high level proto to step in and play, but at least it seems like they had a good time with it.
Yeah, and it's Roman Estoreja and Patrick Kauka. So I've heard Patrick Kauka is decent, but that's tough to. I mean, Travis is good. So these are players that are relatively new or a little less known. And, you get in that matchup against that team and it's kind of a lose-lose situation. Yeah. It was 11-2, 14-12. But either way, that was kind of fun that he got to do that. I guess Riley Newman and Tim Parks, the Hard Eights owner, had a little bit of the same situation when Tyson had to pull out of a tournament earlier this year. So, they have fun with it. All good.
Yeah, no, 100%. So, that's that. I'm going to play Philly this weekend, though. Let's go. I haven't hit a ball since St. Louis, so I'm going to be going in a little cold. But as long as the shoulder's feeling okay, then I think we should do just fine.
Well, I think the shoulder will be fine.
Yeah.
Given the cortisone situation, I don't know exactly when that wears off or how exactly that works. But I know it's a little bit of a help and a little bit of a mask as well. So, I know multiple people a couple times for tennis elbow and some other injuries got one, and next month or 6 weeks was not too shabby. So hopefully that's the same for you.
Yeah. I mean, he's basically said I wouldn't be able to damage it further. And
That's nice reassurance for sure.
Like it was just going to be more of just, managing the pain and getting through it. So, he certainly didn't say it was going to make it better, but he's just like, this is what you do for a living. This is going to be a little bit of part of it until you can really take time off and really rehab.
Well, at least it was not at one time. I'm not saying degenerative or grinding a joint down is a great situation, but when you hear a pop or it happens at once, that seems to be almost always the worst case scenario. So, good luck, buddy. Light them up in Philly.
That's it.
Who you got up there?
I got Andre and Glasman for that one.
Glasman, couple tall folks, huh? Get a tall one. I've done that a couple times in my career as well. Just get a tall one, see what happens,
Yeah, just roll the dice.
correct. So were you able to watch any of the Tournament of Champions or any of the play this weekend?
Yeah, I watched a ton of it. We can dig into that. I watched a fair amount of the Gamma Pickleball Classic, which you probably didn't get to see much of on that concrete floor.
Woo. Yeah. Oh, I flipped it on. I looked at the floor. My shins started throbbing and I just had to turn it off,
Every step hurt just watching.
I mean, I played on tile at a place my first like few months of playing, and it is absolutely different and very brutal. So all I know is I saw Frank Anthony Davis slide about 15 feet, and that was fun. every time he posts one of those videos or those points, it's just too good with Sobek off into the barrier on the side, and then Frank like full Superman diving across the court. I mean, I don't care who you are. That's good stuff.
I mean, that's just Frank Anthony Davis is like perfect conditions indoors on an odd surface where people aren't used to it. And you could just, drive people through the mud. Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. So I saw a little bit of that. And of course I was at Tournament of Champions. So I got to do some commentary and some hanging out in old Brigham City, Utah. And I tell you what, it might not have been the overall number of fans from a handful of the PPA stops, but pound for pound, Brigham City, Utah pickleball fans are pretty legit. And there was a pretty solid vibe through good portions of the weekend. So it was fun. I've had a lot of play and a lot of time in Brigham City on those courts. So I enjoyed my time there. Got to play a little bit and commentate a little bit. And I thought overall, with some of the bigger names out, and you know, some of these middling players starting to rise and make their presence known, there were some very quality matches and lots of three games and lots of, you know, people in big spots that maybe haven't been in too many big spots throughout their pickle career. And I think that makes for good stuff.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It looked like not a very big crowd on Thursday Wednesday. It was Wednesday, right? For singles?
Correct. Everything was shifted up one day, right?
Which probably has a big part of it, right? It's like middle of the day on a weekday, not most conducive to getting fans out there and watching and supporting. So super understandable that, you know, crowds are going to be sparse. But yeah, it did seem like as the week went on that crowds got good and Championship Saturday looked fantastic. So, I mean, tough place to, I know there's tradition there, but it's a tough place to have a tournament. It's just not super centrally located in a town that's small without a lot of amenities. It just makes it a little difficult. But I mean, Utah's probably the best state in the country in terms of pickleball fans and players and people showing up. So, are we going to expect to see TOC continuing to happen under the PPA umbrella moving forward next year, Adam, or are they looking to move the location and kind of get rid of the history?
I don't know. There's some slight buzz about it and a little bit of talk. So, to be honest with you, I don't really care. I think that Brigham City has a couple things that are good, and moving it to Ogden or even all the way south to Salt Lake City, I think that that would be a positive in some factors, but I'm not sure it would be all positive. So I don't think it really matters from my perspective. And, you know, it's not always the best to, you know, when you travel to a place, you have to have a layover and then you have to drive when you get there. That does make the travel more difficult. But once I got to Brigham, I never even sniffed traffic. And every time I plug something into my phone, it was 4 minutes away. And that's kind of nice too. So
yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, there's two ways to do it, right? Like when I played TOC 2 years ago, I think, 2 years ago, it's the only time I've ever played it, but I have a good friend in Salt Lake and I just, you know, get off the airplane, stay at my buddy's place. It's 10 minutes from the airport. And then I don't really mind when you go play an event, you're there pretty much all day anyways, right? It's not like you're going to play your match, going home, back. It's just like you get to the venue, and other than like getting a bite to eat or maybe leaving to grab a coffee or something, you're pretty much at the venue all day. So I didn't mind staying in Salt Lake and then doing the hour 20 drive in the morning. Nobody's on the road. It's, you know, listen to music, podcasts, whatever, and then have the hour ride home to decompress. Like, it wasn't terrible.
Yeah, I think really the only main issue for me is really food choices and maybe like rain delay, possible break, end up at the venue later. Are you going to have any non-Arby's options, you know, at like 10 or 11 p.m.? But
the answer is no.
Yeah, the answer is no. But I'm not partying. I'm not going to clubs. I'm not going out when I'm at these tournaments. So if it's in a little bit of a smaller place, I don't really care. So, yeah, whatever. I history, keep it in Brigham. Let's go.
There we go. You heard it here. Keep it in Brigham. I did see Connor Pardo say something about there's going to be a PPA tour stop in Salt Lake in maybe January.
I did see that. And I mean, you said it just 5 minutes ago. It's probably the best or one of the top two or three states in terms of pickleball enthusiasts and fandom and quite a plethora of pro players as well. So there's a lot of reasons please.
I mean, Salt Lake in January, you could have a winter storm come through. You could have players that don't know how to drive in the snow from Florida.
I mean, they can't do that in January outside, can they?
It won't be outside. Regardless, Minnesota in February this year, it was like, you know, massive storm came through, didn't know if they were going to have it. Like, it just, it's still issues just doing it in a winter place in winter months.
Oh, you have to drive different on the snow?
No, just drive the same. You'll be fine.
Just drive the same. Okay. Sounds good. Yeah. I'll tell you what, Prof and I, we were going to Park City and somebody suggested that it would be okay to not have four-wheel drive or snow, the chains on the tires. Yeah. And that didn't work out very well, Rob. So,
you certainly need four-wheel drive. I mean, that's just a must.
One or the other. You need one or the other. We had neither. And that was, like I said, it was an issue, but quite an experience nonetheless. So,
yeah, just a good adventure.
Yeah.
So just to talk about TOC, I mean, clean Selkirk sweep, baby.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's wild.
Like, has that happened? Like, I don't think has that ever happened where every pro event's been swept? I mean, not in the recent past couple of years since the tours were started.
I don't think so. I don't see how. Maybe if I thought about it a little deeper, I could come up with something, but off the top of my head, I don't see how. So, I mean, I know
we'll have people respond to this and let us know, but I don't think it's happened.
Yeah. And I understand there was a name or two or a couple names not there, but I mean, TM, man, what the hell? Like, dude doesn't miss. He's playing big. He's playing left. He's playing right, whatever he needs to do. And I mean, every time I watch him play, he just doesn't miss a ball.
Yeah. And it was interesting. Like,
yeah,
they put him on the left. Right. So,
yeah.
And I think I was talking to Ignatowicz about this and I was like, it feels like when James plays the left and even if he's on the right and he's the one kind of being the aggressor and speeding up, that Tyson's not always necessarily ready. I think it's no secret. I would say Tyson would probably say that James has faster hands anyways. So it's a little easier to catch Tyson off guard if James is the one speeding up and Tyson maybe not being ready. But if Tyson's playing the left and he's able to move Dinks around and he's able to find his spots and be the aggressor, James is pretty much always going to be ready on that second ball, and Tyson's going to be ready because he's the one initiating. So I think it's a super smart strategy in terms of having Tyson on the left and him being the aggressor because his partner is going to be ready.
Yeah. And James did not play that hybrid right side role. He was pretty much rock. He was dinking and countering. And I was in the air. I got to see the last two games on a layover in Chicago, but it wasn't. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of different ways to play right. We've seen, say, DJ Young play right recently, and he's never going to be a full on grinder. It's a speed it up, clean it up situation, but this was full rock right from Ignatowicz. And I texted with him a little bit, and yeah, I think what you said and what he said makes a lot of sense. Is he can handle the speed ups from Riley, possibly a little bit better. And after his partner speeds up, which is going to happen much more frequently on the left for Tyson, he's going to be on that next one, second, third, fourth, whatever the case may be. So it obviously did not work for a couple games. And it seemed like James kind of found his rhythm and what I saw kind of balancing out, sitting forehand a few times when Riley would speed up the line, and then the full slide with the one-handed punch as well. I know he got caught a couple times that I saw, but for the most part, when he hits the counter clean, it's very good. So, I mean, I would slide a lot to my right when I played Riley, and sure, I would hit some good counters, but they're just not as devastating as James. A lot of times I would hit my counter and win the point, and most of the time I would hit the counter and the point would continue. Yeah. Maybe we would have the advantage, but a lot of times the point would continue. But when James hits it well, point over quite a bit.
And it helps. I mean, just pure size, right? He's sitting up higher with his paddle. He's going to be able to hit down on it a little bit easier than, say, you or I would be able to. So, I mean, that's a big advantage in having a big guy, which you don't see a lot on the right side, having a big guy on the right. But being able to counter and counter down isn't something you always see.
I mean, who knows? In 5 years, every right side player might look like DJ or James, you know, like 6'2", 6'3", just shifted from left to right. I mean, who really knows?
Yeah, that's what you see in every sport, right? Like now, tennis, it's like you're small if you're not 6'6 and moving like, you know, Monfils. So it's like,
right.
Everything's getting bigger.
Yeah. So, and he, it was funny because I told you we messaged a little bit afterwards and, you know, he was just, I don't know, man, maybe I should just be a right side guy, you know, just after a big win, of course.
Yeah,
and, you know, it worked out nice and it was able to beat Riley and this and that. So it was just funny to hear him, you know, fired up about the right side after playing well and getting the W. But yeah, that was, I mean, from what I saw, like I said, the last two games, pretty damn intense match, huge energy and crowd involvement and very high quality points with, you know, a variety of exchanges and a little bit of everything. And, you know, that's what it's all about.
What was, you were there. What was, I know it was hot. Mm-hmm. And I also know it's elevation and kind of thinner air. How was the ball playing? Was everything fast? Was it hard to keep balls down? What was it?
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, I mean, I got on court and I hit several head high drops in mid court. So yeah. I would say it was slightly less intense than normal because the heat of the ball. So the ball, it certainly was nowhere near squishy Florida, very humid type pickleball, but it was slightly softer, so that counteracted just a little bit of the altitude, I believe. I still think the altitude had more effect than what the ball gave back, but it wasn't as extreme as in years past where I've seen it at Tournament of Champions.
Yeah. Yeah, we saw sometimes in that finals or that gold medal match with Ignatovic and Tyson, James was having a tough time keeping that drop down, so Tyson started taking all of them.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's the smart play. You know, he's, you know, he might be a whatever, a top. If every point started neutrally at the kitchen, you know, James might be a top couple player in the world. But when he might be a 4-0 or a 4-5 from the back of the court, and he'll be the first one to tell you that. So, you know, that was probably one of the strengths of my game. And I struggled with it very much the times I played up there. So yeah. I don't blame the players and James for leaving a couple shoulder high. And it really was a recurring theme throughout a lot of the matches. Lots of teams' percentages of making it to the kitchen was not what it normally is. And that was very big factor in all of those close matches, the frequency which team was making it to the kitchen, and the percentages were not awesome, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. No, just an impressive performance by Tyson for sure. I mean, that was – you know, he's going for the triple crown going into the day. I think, you know, if there's any match that he was not favored in, it was going to be that men's doubles match, that first one. And to be down 2-0 and then to claw your way back to taking it 3-2, I mean, kind of springboard his momentum going into the next two events. But, dude, that for that dude to be that fresh, you know, after a five-game men's, after a grindy mixed, and then to have to play singles, I mean, it's a big deal and looked super fresh at the end. So,
yeah, no, definitely impressive.
I thought he was going to be in trouble against Connor because I'm like, oh, Connor's going to be so fired up. He's just waiting in the wings, watching Tyson out here grinding, and Connor's going to be super fresh, and Tyson's going to be kind of, yeah, certainly not as fresh. And Tyson looked just as fresh in singles as Connor.
Yeah. So what exactly happened in singles and mixed in terms of, I know who won, but how, like in terms of closeness or how the matches went, I didn't see either one.
No, I didn't catch all the mixed, but I saw most of singles. And I know Connor had a big lead in game two. So Tyson, I think it was 6-6 in the first, I believe. Tyson pulled away 1-11-6, I think. And then Connor jumped out to a big lead in game two, either 9-2 or 9-3 or something. And yeah, I don't think I think Tyson won that game 12-10 or 11-9. And just, I don't know. I chalk that up to experience. And, you know, maybe Connor looks at Tyson as a little bit of a mentor. I know, you know, I've spent time up in Coeur d'Alene with Connor and Tyson at the same time. So I think maybe there's definitely a mental edge that Tyson has over Connor. And I think that kind of showed in that game too, where, you know, Tyson claws way back in and then mentally went over the top. And yeah, it's a good grindy day and, you know, well-deserved.
Yeah. That's real stuff there. You know, not that it's a full on teacher pupil situation, but just that bringing them in a little bit, like you said, taking them to, his little compound that I talked to him about is getting remodeled and is getting real nice. I think he's putting four courts in and a man cave and a podcast room and all that stuff. So sure, Connor won't be the first one to head up there and train a little bit with Mr. McGuffin. But I think that that makes a lot of sense mentally and in a big spot, and not that Connor won't get over that hump very soon, but it is a factor, and it is there in terms of a mental perspective, and that could be the what gets you over the hump in those super tight matches.
Adam, I think we got to get up there for some Selkirk action, and then, you know, maybe reignite your career a little bit. I don't know if you can do 6 a.m. training sessions, because that's what Tyson does, but.
Well, I played a little 4-5 pickleball for an hour on Friday, and my left leg hasn't been the same since. So, I'm not sure this career is going to get revitalized anytime soon or ever, but it's possible. We'll just say it's in the realm of possible outcomes. But yeah, it's struggling. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, you just got to play.
For you. And it was fun. And I did enjoy that, even though all of my slice returns went 6 inches out. It's okay. It's okay, Rob.
Well, then the other triple crown was Catherine, which what was the women's score? Do you have that in front of you?
I do not. I don't have the single score. I have the doubles. Let's take a little look. So yeah, she was in almost 2 month break, I believe. And I think that totaled 3 tournaments, if I remember correctly. But we've seen a couple. I think as we move forward, we're going to see there's not really an off season in pickleball. So I think players are going to start to find little slivers or little 3-4 week stretches, or maybe even more like Catherine did, and take a recoup break to disconnect, you know, from the pickleball court. And I think the way the schedule is laid out right now, that is going to benefit a lot of players and be something that I think is borderline necessary.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And not to get too far off topic here, but one thing I did see somebody write and say is that PPA is going to have 40 events in 2024. I don't know if that's true. That was just something I read. I don't know. That wasn't directly from the PPA or directly from Connor, but I think somebody said that Connor did an interview maybe on the Tennis Channel that said 40 events in 2024. I'm not sure. I just know that's, I don't know if that's all pro or if they're doing something else, but 40 events is crazy. And you're going to have players taking significant little gaps just to recharge and mentally be fresh and physically be fresh. But, on that note, no 2024 schedule released yet, which is interesting with the PPA, and also kind of up in the air with what's going on with MLP and where that merger is supposed to happen. And, you know, I think somebody asked, like, are there any questions on Twitter that you want us to ask Connor Pardo, because he's going to come on the podcast. And I was like, yeah, what's it going to look like with PPA and MLP moving forward? Like, do you guys not see that, like, there are conflicting goals? And yeah, I don't know if that's been answered, but I'm really curious to see what's going to happen with PPA, MLP, not just a few years from now, but you know, as soon as next year. What do those schedules look like? How many events does MLP have? How many does PPA have? Is there any overlap? What's the are PPA contracted players going to play both? Because if, let's say, MLP keeps increasing events, let's say there are 8 MLP events next year, I mean, players are going to want to play more than, call it, 8 PPA events as well. So, and I assure you that the PPA is going to want their players to play more than 8 PPAs. So I'll be really curious to see kind of how this unfolds with PPA, MLP, and what it looks like next year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a reasonable question without expanding how many tournaments they're playing. But if this is 40 or close to it from PPA plus a possible 8 or, you know, outside chance of 12 maybe from MLP, something along those lines, I mean, that's a very good question. And it's going to have to get, you know, answered or figured out, because, I mean, I think we just talked about the breaks being necessary if you're playing low or mid-20s tournaments in a year. Imagine if those numbers jump up. So what are they going to pick? Where are they going to dip out? You know, because they're going to have to, unless they want to play possibly 40 plus tournaments, which is obscene. So you got to trim the fat somewhere. You know, where are you going to trim it as a pro player? I don't know exactly.
Yeah, it'll be. Yeah. So if you are PPA or MLP, let us know. What's the plan, boys?
Yeah.
Ladies, what are we doing?
What's the plan? And just to touch on that women's final, we had Elise and Callie taking game one, 11-8, then a very comfortable 11-5, 11-5, 11-1 victory for CP and Paris Todd, who, you know, wasn't going to play and then got in there, I guess, when CP calls, pretty reasonable to make an unscheduled trip to Utah.
Certainly. And I the unique thing is that, you know, that with that clean sweep of the Selkirk, you had several different paddles being used too. I think Tyson's playing with the 002, or he did this tournament.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think James is playing with the 002A, which is a little softer version of the 002. You had Paris playing with, it looked like, the 006, which is kind of the Labs product. I believe it's a Selkirk Labs product. Mm-hmm. That is, has a lot of grit and feels nice. And then you had Catherine playing with the Power Air, which is what I play with. I think what you play with, Adam. So look, a wide array of pro paddles being used for this clean sweep, which is very interesting.
Love that. Great. Yeah. Great mention there, Rob. And
we gotta call out Selkirk.
Yeah, well, absolutely we do. And I hadn't even considered the variety of paddles in use. And you know, when you have 5-6 more models being used at the highest level, you're doing something right, huh?
Yeah, no. So pretty interesting stuff. And it's, you know, just a testament to how slim margins are. Talking about another Selkirk player, Susanna Barr, she partnered up with Vivian Glosman, I believe. And I mean, nearly took out our eventual gold medal champions, right?
Yeah.
I think so, like, it was deep in the third.
Yeah. So I believe it was, I'll find it real fast, but that was on grandstand, I believe, when I was commentating center, and I kept kind of in the truck, we have the monitors up and I kept looking over, and that was, oh, they have the live scoring now too, which is pretty cool.
From
when the refs have the iPads from outer courts, you can see the score, which is really nice. So we have, yes. So it was 11-5, 5-11, 12-10 in the third for Vivian Glosman and Susanna Barr. And so they win pretty easy first round against Dylan Ciampini and Avery Beck. They have a tight match against the eventual gold medalist, and they're out of the tournament. No more play. So no backdraw, no nothing. Right there, and then it's all over. That's tough. That's pretty tough.
That's wild, huh? Like, I mean – I don't know if they had any. I don't know if they had any match points. They very well could have, Susanna and Vivian, mm-hmm. but it's just just showing how slim those margins are, and easily the eventual champions could have easily been out of the tournament in that round. But Adam, on that note, it's a good point. We have this new format that's been rolling the past few tournaments with the PPA, which is it's a backdraw for the first round, but only for the first round losers. After that, it's single elim, and you get to the semis, you're guaranteed top four. What are your thoughts on this after seeing it for a few tournaments now? Because I've got a couple of thoughts, but I want to hear what you think about it so far.
Well, it's tough for those players. I think it was brought up briefly when Tim Parks was on, and we discussed, all of us discussed how, like, valuable – tournament reps are, and it's just never the same in rec. And I mean, I'm talking something ridiculous like 10x, 20x, 30x the experience when you're playing tournament play to rec play. So it does. And then Tim kind of went on that spiel about how all the top players get, you know, 10, 12, 14 hours a weekend of quality court time, and all the up and comers and middling players are. It's very possible you could play solid pickleball and be on court for 3 or 4 hours for all three events combined. So I think that's a pretty big deal. And I think just from like the overall tournament experience from the pro level, I maybe you can label that as part of the deal, but I think it is very tough developmentally for these players trying to crack that top, you know, 20, 25 or so. And so that's kind of how I feel.
Yeah. It's, I think it's also tough for, you have all these people that signed with the PPA that are not able to play anything else. And now they're even, if I'm a signed PPA player, I'm probably a little annoyed, right? Like I go into the year thinking, you know, this is great. I'm getting these appearance fees. I'm going to be able to develop, you know, if you're, let's call it kind of like not the very top tier, but kind of second, third tier. I mean, just think about how many fifth place, you know, fifth places that Pablo and Federico got, right? They got a ton of good reps in that back draw. And I'm not saying the back draw is great because you can only get fifth, but I'm just saying in terms of high quality reps, they got a lot. They got a lot in that back draw this whole year. But now the fact that, you know, those are gone, like even think about like Deckel, dude. Like Deckel's not, like you don't hear his name that much anymore. He's not constantly in the medal discussion. And it's tough. It's tough to where you don't have that chance to come back around.
I totally agree. And I mean, fourth, fifth, sixth, even the seventh, eighth spot. A lot of times previously, you would get, even if you got fifth, sixth, you would get two pretty damn good backdraw matches against quality opponents.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's just not there anymore. Seems like if you are going to get to that fifth, sixth or seventh, eighth, you know, with the pullouts and the people not playing that, I mean, it's just a lot different than it used to be. And more than a couple ways.
Yeah. And it's heavily geared towards seeding too, right? It's like makes it tough. Unless, especially if you're like a non PPA player going to play PPAs where, you know, you don't have many PPA points, you're going to be a bad seed and it could really disrupt the draw.
Yeah. PPA points. Yeah. That's, we'll let, what's his name? What's the guy? Gloss. Jim, whatever that guy, we'll let him talk about the PPA seeding, but just a couple touches on the women's draw here. We had a nice run from Hurricane Tyra and Anna Bright, ended up getting the bronze medal. We had Tina Pisnik playing some big ball this weekend. She had a nice run with Andrea Coop, losing 11-8 in the third to Callie Smith and Elise Jones. So just wanted to bring up those two players who did not make it, you know, into that championship match, but had some pretty nice runs. So Tina Pisnik, man, I'll tell you what. I mean, I know she's older, but she plays a smart game. She really does. She picks her spots well. She's very consistent and seems to really get the game only whatever year and a half, whatever the hell it is, into her career early in her career, whatever.
I think the unique thing about Tina is, and I don't know, I haven't heard this talked about much, but she is easily the highest level women's tennis player that's converted over. Easily.
Right.
I mean, she was top 30 in the world, singles, WTA. And that's kind of the first really high level women's tennis player we've seen convert. And we're seeing what she's able to do in a very short amount of time. And I mean, to get to the mixed final gold medal match and earn a silver with Pat, it's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible stuff.
Incredible.
Incredible.
Just mix it together. Just mix it together, buddy. Hey, what you said it like 9 months ago or something. The biggest opportunity in pro sports is women's pickleball, low hanging fruit. So
it is.
There you go. Just high level background jumps in and more than relevant right off the bat. There you go. Perfect example.
Yeah. And I think what impressed me was I thought she was pretty limited in which side she could play. Cause she always played with Martin Emmerich, who's shout out to Martin, teammate on the St. Louis Shock. She would always play the left side with him. And she was just, dude, like you don't want to get into a backhand deke battle with her because she's so sharp with it. Like she hits great backhand deke. So I was like, okay, well, she's going to be on the right side with Pat. Probably not going to see as good of a result. And she's a rock over there on the forehand side. So the fact, and that's super impressive to me because I've seen a lot of the ladies that have come in have been much better at one side versus the other. And she's getting really good results on both sides, and especially on the right side, which she hasn't played much of in terms of mix. So super impressive. I expect her to continue to get better. And, you know, as long as she doesn't seem like she's going to be slowing down anytime soon in terms of, you know, she's a little older, right? 40s, but yeah. doesn't seem like it's going to affect her.
Yeah, I think a perfect example was probably Vivian Glossman. I think she even said it. Like, I'm comfortable on the left in women's. I don't really know what I'm doing on the right in mixed. I mean, this was a couple months ago or whatever. Yeah. But I think that does make sense. And, you know, she been mentored a little bit by Colin Johns. They played at least one, if not a couple tournaments together where she was playing right and Colin was playing left. So I think he, you know, gave her some tips and has maybe worked with her a little bit. And yeah, impressive to be able to not only play at a high level, but go back and forth sides and not really show any issues on either. Good for her. And I'm sure we'll see quite a bit more of her moving forward. And that's a tough break in the mixed final, as yep. I believe it was Pat Smith's back.
No, was it back? I thought it was from the concussion thing the day before.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
I'm not sure though. But
no, that makes it. I mean, I talked to him after that match and he was talking, his vision was messed up.
That's not good.
He was saying like it's not like he was seeing double or anything, but just like some blurry vision and some definite issues about what happened. So I know he also got treatment on his back and has had hip and knee issues before, even though he did not. He was moving much. I mean, I watched him play for like 3 points and I was like, ooh, this is a little different than when I was playing him a year and a half ago or whatever it may be. Yeah. No KT tape, much more. The issue with Pat is when he is struggling physically, he gets stuck. Meaning he's at the kitchen line, he gets stuck committing to something and he can't dink it. He just goes for something crazy. But yeah. When he has that ability to shuffle and really, more importantly, the lunge, the controlled lunge to get underneath the ball, he was really maybe not even – he was moving better, but for me, it's more the bending that really helped him hit some of those shots that he used to. And, you know, he's a player favorite. He's a very nice guy and everybody likes him on tour. So of course I love to see him have a little success when it's been a while for him.
And he got picked up by, on MLP. So yeah. For Brandon French, his wrist is still hurt. Hope it gets better, buddy. That's a shame. Hopefully you'll still be at MLP because French just brings fun environment. Even if people like he can annoy the hell out of a lot of people, but
yeah.
I appreciate him. I think he's great and it's all in good fun and he brings good energy.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And let's see, just checking out a couple scores here in the mixed. We had a very surprising result early on. First round match for the number 2 seed, Ignatowicz and Anna Bright going down 11-7, 11-6 to Andre Daescu and Rachel Rohrabacher. Has to be the biggest upset of the draw. And I was thinking, I mean, I didn't see the match. I have no idea what happened, but I was thinking maybe it could have been something like the Jack Sock situation where he gets matched up with Roddy and Dobran, who are his buddies and kind of know his tricks. I know Rachel Rohrabacher plays with those two down in South Florida. So just maybe something that happened, but you know, this is pickle. Anything can happen at any time, especially at the pro level. So yeah. Result. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, Andre's not going to give you much in terms of errors. If Rachel played solid, which it seems like she did, you know, you can have James go on a streak of missing a fair amount. And yeah. I would assume that, you know, Andre just played pretty clean and he got, you know, Rachel did right. as well. And probably got a fair amount of errors out of James, my guess.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, he's, you know, we're not really talking about 60 or 65% when it's Ignatowicz playing mixed. It's a healthier percentage of court coverage than that. So I'm sure I would guess that he found himself overextended on more than one occasion in that match. Yeah. But like I said, just speculation. I did not see it play out. Just saw the scores and was surprised by that. We had a really tight one here. Zane Navratil and Andrea Coop making a nice run, beating Leung and Glossman. 9-11, 11, 9, 11, 8. And guys, these are second round matches right here. So just wild matchups there. And I know I'm missing a couple. Just wanted to touch on a few of those results from mixed.
And your day's done after that loss, after that tight second round loss.
I know, exactly.
Thanks for coming to Utah.
Bye-bye. Every single game, 11-9, 11-8, 8-11. You know, I mean, come on. These are tight all the way through.
So that was Leung's second round loss?
Correct.
Exactly. He played with Hayden and Mintz, but I think it was also maybe a second round or third round.
Well, let's just figure it out here, Robert.
I'm just saying, like, that's a, you know, it's tough if you don't get through. I mean, you have all the matches are tough. It's just brutal not to get more reps.
Yeah, and I mean, and you're exactly right. I just found it. So we have Leung and Patrick Quinn beating Anthony Gonzalez and Nick Vanderwerf, who I'm sure are quality up-and-coming players and very nice guys, but I do not know them. So they win that pretty comfortably. And then they lose 11-3, 11-7 to Alshon and Garnett, who looked very good. And that's it. I mean, that's two short matches. That's not even like a really tight second round. And that's that. And I'll just continue up the draw here. We have Garnett and Alshon defeating Stacksrud and Tellez 12-10, 12-10.
Yeah.
And then, you know, getting defeated by Ignatowicz and Tyson McGuffin. But I was pretty impressed with Alshon, who is
on the right.
Probably 85-90%+ of his pickleball in his career has been on the left. Mm-hmm. And the match that I called, he handled himself just fine over there. Loading backhand, even loading forehand some. And I don't think in that match that I called, he did more than one or two silly speed ups. So good adjustment for him. And I was impressed with his right side play, to be honest with you.
Agree. I saw a few little pokes with his backhand in the middle too, which worked out most times. So yeah, big props. Played well.
Yeah. And then we had, this was another match that I called. It was Kohler and Newman versus Julian Arnold and Thomas Wilson. And I'll tell you what, Julian Arnold went absolutely crazy. I know he takes a lot of court and you know, that was a lot of their success in MLP, you know, with Thomas being that established supporting player. But I think Julian overextended quite a bit, even more so than I've seen him in quite a while in this match. And it cost him, even though the second game was very tight at 14-12.
Who was that against? Sorry.
So it was Kohler and Newman versus Julian and Thomas. And there was that slight dynamic where Riley's playing with Julian and with Kohler at least a couple more times each. I don't know how much, but I think maybe there was something trying to be proved there. And Pat and Jay playing some good ball as well. Being Rafa Hewitt and Zane Navratil comfortably, and then losing in three to Kohler and Newman. So Pat, great job. I saw a couple matches of Jay as well in mixed and men's, and it looked a little bit different than it has the last couple months. I think he played well also. So great to see the old schoolers kind of get back in the mix with some solid results.
Yeah, I like it. And if Pat can keep playing well, I mean, I don't know what they have going on with partnerships the remainder of the year, but I wouldn't mind seeing a little Wichita reunion out of those guys. I mean, over the past couple of years, they've had amazing results, then kind of both broke off and explored with different partners. But I mean, they know each other's game really well. And if Pat's able to be healthy and, you know, be a rock on the right, he's good over there. Cause he's got great counters. It's just a matter of, can he move, like you said, and not get stuck on the dinks.
Yeah. Heavy handed. Yeah. And I think maybe that was, you know, it was great success, but might have caused that breakup was that amazing kind of summer that Jay had, where he was literally winning almost every tournament on the APP tour. He had some great results in the PPAs as well. And I think that that's kind of what caused that breakup as Jay wanted to step up with a higher octane partner. Not that that was the wrong decision or he stepped all over Pat, not saying that at all, but possibly that was the, you know, the kind of the straw that broke the camel's back to break them up. But when they're together, the energy's real. And I think they get the most out of each other.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's a real thing. And after watching Riley play a little bit, it's hard not to see maybe some other players not quite as talented as him lifting their partner's level. And that doesn't necessarily happen all the time with Riley. And when we're talking about razor thin edges with elite talent all over the court, these things matter, Rob.
No, you're absolutely right. It's been interesting to see. Riley still hasn't gotten that hasn't gotten that gold since that split, right? So we didn't see Matt Wright this weekend. We'll see him in Kansas City, I believe. So, Matt's and playing Matt, with Colin's brother.
Yeah, Matt's going to have a pretty dang good chance to win that next tournament. So, we'll just have to monitor this moving forward. But certainly interesting when you have a little breakup like that and maybe the quote-unquote better player of the group struggling more than that person that he broke apart from. So I do believe that their breakup was mutual, but it's it's interesting nonetheless.
Adam, what else?
In terms of results, that's pretty much it. I know I look past something, but those are some of the highlights for me and some of the quality matches and results. And I very much enjoyed commentating this tournament and was really fun to see a variety of players in big spots.
I got a question. Let's just get a little weird. I was in England when I think there are conversations happening around the Pro XR paddle. I heard from somebody that it was like banned for the weekend. Then I heard that it wasn't. And let's just talk about it. What's going on with the Pro XR paddle? It is, in my opinion, outrageous what you could do with it. And what some play, like, it depends on the player, right? Some players have strokes that aren't super conducive to it, but some players have, but some players can use a full Western and trust that it's going to grab the ball, and it does grab the ball. So I don't know what's been going on with the PPA and the Pro XR.
All I know about the Pro XR is I just wanted to check out the grittiness and I rubbed my finger on it and it started bleeding. joking, but yeah, you're, and I think that's a good point too, is you might not notice how much a certain paddle gives you by your style, but when you get the proper paddle matched up with the proper style, watch out, that's really different. And well, you know what, Robert, I think I actually have one. Oh, there we go. We got the collab with the Hard 8 Pro XR, and my God, like, that's rough. I know other paddles have been described as sandpaper, but that's pretty much it. Never hit it. Don't know what the power situation is. The only thing I know is I have rubbed my finger on it, and it is very gritty, sir.
Yeah, and I've heard, I don't remember who I was talking to, but I don't remember quite the testing rules, but I heard on several occasions that like the paddle would get tested, 2 out of 3 would fail, 1 would come back okay, but since the 1 was okay, that it passed.
I think if any paddle
is over the reading period, it should be deemed disqualified or not able to use. The fact that it's like, okay, it fails 2 out of 3, but the third one was okay. Now that's okay. I think if we want to have the level be pretty consistent across the board, that we need to be a little bit more conservative with how we're doing it. And I think if there's any test that fails, it should be deemed, you know, disqualified or illegal. So I don't know why that's not the case and why we do 2 out of 3 or whatever it may be, but it just seems a little silly. And I think it would create a situation where if any of the tests fail, that manufacturers would have to be pretty conservative and tame with how they go about creating the paddles, which is, I think, what we want, because it's about having a level playing field regardless of what paddle you're using, which I don't think we have right now. I don't think we have a level playing field with the different paddles out there, which is crazy. Because it's not something you'd ever think about, like in tennis. It's like people have preferences on, you know, this racket versus this one, strings, that kind of thing. But there's never like a disparity it's never that you don't have a level playing field based on what you're using, which right now I think there is. And I hope they make some, you know, steps to change that.
Yeah, I agree. There's no way it's a level playing field, and I'm not even talking about anything specifically. And of course, Robert, I'm a high-end content creator. I'm not an engineer, but is there something along the difference in how you put the grit on your paddle and the ability to test it? Is that something that I have heard? Because I've heard there's like a standard grit And then there's a couple other companies that are doing something differently, and they're having trouble kind of quantifying that type of grab on the pickleball. Is that correct?
I've heard that as well. And I've heard that the paddle companies are basically able to stay kind of one step ahead of the current testing methods, which is smart, right? Until the testing methods are better, then you, as a paddle company, you're going to want to have the edge. So they're not doing anything illegal, right. But it sounds like once the testing changes, which it's supposed to be in Q4 here, to where the way it was described to me was kind of like topographical, where, you know, you have a machine that's able to see kind of not just the surface, but what's kind of going on just below the surface. And it'll give a better reading of what that, of the roughness is and the friction. And so I don't know, like you said, I'm not an engineer either. I'm just a high end content creator that sometimes plays pickleball when he's not hurting. Uh-huh. But I think we're moving in the right direction, but I think, yeah, we need to do things to level the playing field.
Yeah. Until it gets to a certain point, it might be this kind of cat and mouse game. I'm not talking about PEDs and pickleball. That's how it's been for like 30 years or 40 years with steroids.
Yeah.
They do it, they figure out how to catch them, and then they stay. It's a back and forth. It's a cat and mouse. It's one step ahead. So, not the same situation, but kind of similar. So maybe the more you go back and forth, you might get to a point where it's much more difficult to stay ahead. But probably right now, and maybe for the next couple sets of testing, that there will be ability to be ahead of the game. And like you said, there's big monetary gains. You're not doing anything illegal. If you're a paddle company, you want the hot ticket item, and they're going to, when we're talking big time bucks, they're going to do what they have to do to make that happen. And if there's no one to smack them on the wrist, just expect it to continue.
Yeah. And what's even talking about big time bucks, I mean, what's even wilder to me is that with MLP, actually the last MLP, they were only testing for deflection. If my memory serves me correctly, they weren't testing for surface roughness or anything else, which, I mean, there's no bigger dollars in pickleball than MLP right now. And to have it that unregulated, where you're not testing the paddle in all aspects of the paddle, is something that has to change. Like the fact that you can, like, you know, that they're only testing for deflection, go crazy on the grit. Right.
Yeah. Right. Like, and no, well, absolutely. And like, I mean,
yeah,
I mean, D-lammed paddles hit harder. I mean, deflection hits harder, but when you have spin, you're allowed to hit harder. You basically have the freedom to hit
as hard
as you want. You can swing out. You can completely swing out. It just gives you the margin to fully release on the ball. And if you're releasing on every shot and they're going in, my God, what an advantage that is. As you know, some paddles players might only be able to fully release on a handful of shots because of the spin component. So it's we're going to be talking about this for months, maybe hopefully months and not years. But level playing field is absolutely at the core of all this, and it just needs to be there.
Yeah, and you know, everybody's doing their best, or so they say. So we'll get there.
I was waiting if you were going to follow that up with anything. I think the tone of the initial comments said enough as it was. But Robert, looks like we're creeping on that hour mark. What do you say? Got anything else?
No, I say we close it down, baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was fun. This was a nice flowy catch up, Adam. That was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we normally have maybe a slight pause at some point, but it just flowed.
And this is the afternoon. Maybe we're new people. Oof. Maybe we're afternoon guys.
9 a.m. next week, buddy. I can't do afternoon.
No, Monday is the rest of the semester. You're done. Sorry.
Well, I can do it. I can do it early. So or, I think she goes in at 11. I think she goes in at 11 on Monday. So we'll just have to see. But either way, nice chatting there, pal, and best of luck in Philly. And we'll run this back next week, bud.
Yes, sir. All right, bye, everybody.
Because you know why?
Why?
Because it feels right.
It feels right. Legendary. Yeah.